Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, you've heard these words a lot: immigration, deportation, and now increasingly intervention. So how does our government impact our daily lives and our families, especially when we're anonymous?
You know, he was very emotional and says, you know, hijo, I can go in peace now because I know where your uncle is now.
The government deported dozens of men and never named them, even after they died in a plane crash. What it meant in 1948 and what it means to their families now. And intervention from a peace president?
Let me make something clear. The United States military doesn't do pinpricks.
Potential U.S. intervention in Syria on the 40th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup against Chilean President Salvador Allende. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. With the looming prospect of U.S. strikes on Syria, the word that keeps coming up over and over again in our newsroom is intervention. Many of us remember past U.S. interventions in Latin America, like the U.S.-backed coup in Chile 40 years ago this week, on September 11, 1973. Intervention is a part of a history that binds us as Latinos. It's what brought immigrants who never thought they would have to leave their home countries to the United States. Interventions in places like Chile.
Ante estos hechos, solo me cabe decirle a los trabajadores, yo no voy a renunciar.
Nicaragua.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
The Dominican Republic.
A three-man junta has been named to rule the Dominican Republic as a rebel movement collapses. It was an attempt to reinstate exiled President Juan Bosch, and U.S. Marines were ordered into the country to protect American lives. The Leathernecks were airlifted to the capital of Santo Domingo, where they killed two snipers.
And too many other places to name. Whether we were pushed out by war or whether we chose to come to the U.S. for opportunity, there's often a heavy price paid for that decision. Like what happened on January 28, 1948, when a plane crashed in Los Gatos Canyon near Fresno, California. Everyone aboard was killed. 4 U.S. crew members and 28 Mexicans who were being deported. News reports named the Americans who died, but left the Mexicans anonymous. That spurred folk singer Woody Guthrie to write a protest song that became an anthem for migrant workers' rights. Here's his son, Arlo Guthrie, singing the song.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mi amigos, Jesus y Maria. You won't have a name when you ride. And all they will call you will be deportees. Some of us are illegal, and others not wanted. Our work contract's out, and we have to move on. 600 miles to the Mexico border. They chase us like outlaws, like rustlers and thieves. We died in your hills and we died on your deserts. We died in your valleys, we died on your plains.
The victims' identities really did get lost to history. Until now. Valerie Hamilton has our story.
The headline said something to the effect of 100 people see a ship fall from the sky. Tim Hernandez was in the Fresno County Library 3 years ago, scanning microfilm of 1940s newspapers.
By the time, you know, I was about halfway through with reading that article, I realized, you know, that it was the same incident that Woody Guthrie had written his song, The Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, about.
Tim is a writer in Colorado, but he grew up in California, the son of migrant workers, like the ones who died in the crash.
And because of the sort of, you know, things I've seen happen to my folks, my family, you know, cousins, relatives, uncles, aunts, grandfather, it was really a question in my mind of who these people were.
Now my father's own father, he waited that room. They took all the money that he made in his life.
The article didn't name the Mexican victims, but Tim was convinced the names were out there somewhere. So he went looking. He found a list online, but it was full of holes. He went to the Fresno County records, but was turned away because he wasn't a relative. He phoned the church that buried the victims, but no one called him back. Finally, after 2 years, one door opened.
My name is Carlos Rasco, and I'm the director of cemeteries for the Catholic Church here in Fresno.
The victims lie in a mass grave at the edge of Holy Cross Cemetery behind an airstrip. There's just one small brass marker that reads,
28 Mexican citizens who died in an airplane accident near Colinga, California on January 28th, 1948, RIP, which is rest in peace.
The cemetery's own records didn't have their names either.
And when we open that page from 1948, it just said Mexican nationals 28 times.
Carlos thought that immigration should have the names. After all, they chartered the plane. But when he called, he got stuck in a phone tree.
Thank you for calling United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. To continue in English, press 1.
Press 1 if you're this, press 2 if you're renewing, press this. So I was like, who do I, you know, I need somebody to talk to me to say, who do I call to look up genealogy? I never got that call back.
This time, Carlos went to the Fresno Hall of Records on official business to complete the cemetery's files. He came out with 28 death certificates and 28 names.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesus and Maria. You are...
Jesus Mesa Santos, Maria Santana Rodriguez. The deportees were no longer just metaphors, but human beings with names and stories.
There's a lot of people that leave their home states and countries, and the name is pretty much all they carry with them.
Carlos and Tim wondered if the victims' families might still be looking for them after all these years. Tim put out the word through a local Spanish-language newspaper in Fresno. 2 weeks later, he got an email.
In Spanish, it said, Mr. Hernandez, my name is Jaime Ramirez. And I'm the grandson of, and the grandson and the nephew of two of the passengers aboard that airplane.
One was my grandfather, Ramon Paredes Gonzalez. My uncle, Guadalupe Ramirez Lara.
Ramon was 37 when the plane crashed. Guadalupe was 45. Jaime knew them only from family legends, Ramon's five-day poker games, and Guadalupe's big personality.
Guadalupe was very, very funny. My father used to tell me a lot of stories about him. He was not wild, crazy, but he was funny. He used to love horses and sing. They came to work to earn money so they can raise their farm. They had a lot of plans.
When Jaime moved to the U.S., his living grandfather, Guadalupe's brother, asked him to find the grave.
Okay, Grandpa, we will. I didn't know how to start.
In 1989, a lucky guess led him to the Fresno County Records and the Holy Cross Cemetery. He says for his living grandfather, it closed a circle.
You know, he was very emotional and says, you know, hijo, I can go in peace now because I know where your uncle is now. And that's what we wanted, to know where they were buried, because that's what got me going. I say, they cannot be lost. You know, I got to find them. And I found them.
This year, Tim Hernandez and Carlos Rascon raised $10,000 for a new headstone, a granite memorial with all the victims' names inscribed. On Labor Day, the memorial was inaugurated with a celebration at Holy Cross Cemetery.
Luis López Medina.
Descanse en paz.
Luis Cuevas Miranda.
Descanse en paz.
Ignacio Pérez Navarro.
Descanse en paz.
Román Ochoa.
For a lot of Latino folks, it's not often that, you know, that we get our due.
They finally gonna be recognized.
But the old marker for 28 Mexican citizens is still there too, to make sure no one forgets that for decades their names were forgotten. For Latino USA, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Fresno, California. Parts of this mystery are still unsolved. The deportee detectives are still trying to contact families of other crash victims. You can find a full list of their names at latinousa.org. So from time to time, when we hear an exceptional story from one of our reporters, we like to check back in with them to get a little bit of the backstory of the piece. So Valerie Hamilton is joining us now to give a bit of a peek into her reporter's notebook on the story about the song Deportee. Welcome to Latino USA as a guest, Valerie.
Thank you. Thank you.
This was such a beautiful story. How did you come upon it?
Well, it's something that has been, that the song has certainly been a part of my consciousness for my whole life. It's such an, you know, it's something, it's a story that I feel like everyone in my generation probably knows about. But, you know, honestly, I actually read about it in the LA Times.
Right. So in the piece, we heard several different versions of the song, but actually nothing recorded by Woody Guthrie himself. So why didn't that happen if he wrote this song and cared so much about the issue? Why didn't he record it?
It turns out, first of all, that Woody Guthrie didn't record very many of the songs that he wrote. He wrote more than 3,000 songs in his lifetime, and there are only 46 Woody Guthrie recordings that still survive. Although there is sort of a tantalizing clue. I spoke to his old friend and collaborator, a folk singer named Ramblin' Jack Elliott, who swears to me that in 1951, he was standing next to Woody Guthrie in a Decca recording studio when Woody Guthrie recorded his version of Deportee. So there was a recording once, but it was, the song originally was very different from the version that we know today. Woody Guthrie recorded this as a talking blues. Basically, it's like a spoken word performance over a basic blues guitar accompaniment.
So when Woody Guthrie writes this poem, he basically makes up names for these nameless deportees. In fact, it turned out that some of these names actually matched up with the real names of some of the passengers on the plane. So, coincidence?
Yeah, kind of an amazing coincidence, but yes, apparently coincidence. Woody Guthrie did not have the names. The only one that doesn't quite fit is Rosalita, but there was a Rosalio on the plane, so a man's version of the name, which is pretty close. Now, I mean, it has to be said, these were pretty common names at the time, so they were a reasonable guess. But yeah, still a very good guess and quite a coincidence.
Thanks so much for all of your reporting, Valerie. Great to talk to you.
Thank you.
Valerie Hamilton is an independent reporter who works and lives in the Los Angeles area. Coming up, the fate of deportees once they've been deported to Mexico.
I haven't been here in 15 years. No one feels safe in Mexico with all the crime. In the U.S., they speak so badly about Mexico, and more so of the border cities.
That's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For the last 4 years, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, has carried out a controversial detention program called Secure Communities. Here's how it works. When people are arrested, local law enforcement sends their fingerprints to the FBI, which then passes the information on to ICE. If ICE suspects someone's in the country without permission, it can ask for that person to be held for up to 48 hours and then possibly deported. From the beginning, immigrant advocates have said that the Secure Communities program erodes trust between immigrants and local police.
They're afraid to go on the streets. They're afraid to go to work. They're afraid that something is going to happen and the kids are going to be at home alone and they're going to end up being deported.
Some local police have also balked at following the program.
Since the inception of Secure Communities, there's been a sweeping change, such as people in our custody for offenses such as no valid driver's license, being placed on detainers and sent abroad for deportation proceedings. This does not align itself with the reasons for launching Secure Communities and has left myself and many of my contemporaries in law enforcement feel as though we've been sold a bill of goods.
In response, ICE issued a directive last year, allowing its agents more leeway in making detention requests. Even so, several state and local governments across the country have decided to limit their cooperation with ICE, basically challenging the effectiveness of a policy that President Obama has championed. It's a face-off. And now we take you to three places across the country where that's happening.
I'm Adrian Florido in San Diego. Last year, Felipe Porcayo's 23-year-old son was arrested when a fight broke out at this park in a Latino part of town.
The investigation determined that he wasn't involved. He had nothing to do with the fight, but he was deported anyway.
Immigrant advocates say this is a common story when it comes to secure communities. ICE maintains that the program targets serious criminals, but many people arrested for misdemeanors, like driving without a license, have been turned over to ICE and deported. That's a main reason demonstrations have sprung up across California in support of a bill called the Trust Act. The bill would prohibit local jails from turning anyone in their custody over to ICE, unless that person has been accused or convicted of a violent crime. At a recent rally, Viviana Gonzalez, an activist and undocumented immigrant, explained why the bill's new protections are important.
You know, domestic abuse is going unreported, crimes are going unreported because people are too scared. They think, you know, ICE will come attached to local police.
Many politicians and even some police chiefs support the Trust Act, but the State Sheriff's Association opposes it. Its lobbyist, Aaron McGuire, explains.
You get a request from a federal law enforcement agency and to say that you should basically willfully disobey or not cooperate or to thwart that request from law enforcement puts local law enforcement into a difficult position.
Despite those objections, the bill cleared the legislature this week and now awaits the signature of Governor Jerry Brown. For Latino USA, I'm Adrian Florido in San Diego.
I'm Kate Richardson in New Orleans. Two things led to the change in ICE hold policy here in Orleans Parish. One was a federal lawsuit complaining that the parish prison mishandled ICE detention requests. The other was a city council resolution asking the sheriff not to comply with those requests. In a video taken at a recent workers' meeting, Wilmer Toro explains what it was like for undocumented immigrants in the city.
Unfortunately, just because of our ethnic features, we're detained. Just because of our faces. If we're characteristically Latino, they detain us. And we were left in immigration holds.
In May, three city council members co-sponsored the resolution urging a policy change. Part of their argument against ICE holds had to do with budgetary concerns, but they said that their aim was mostly to prevent racial profiling. Orleans Parish Sheriff Marlon Gussman says he would not consider reverting back to his previous policy of complying with ICE.
What we're really talking about here is fundamental rights that are guaranteed to everyone under the Constitution. And this is a right not to be detained unless there's probable cause.
ICE Public Affairs Officer Brian Cox declined to comment on tape. But in a statement, he said, quote, "The identification and removal of criminal offenders is ICE's highest priority," end quote. He said that the agency has implemented reforms that allow it to focus on those individuals. For Latino USA, I'm Kate Richardson in New Orleans.
I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel in New Haven, Connecticut.
In July, Connecticut became the first state to pass a version of the Trust Act. The legislation was spurred by the arrest last year and long detention of an undocumented immigrant from Mexico. His sister, Juana Islas, explains.
I don't trust the police. I'm afraid because of what happened to my brother.
Juana's brother, Jose Maria Islas, spent 1 year behind bars after being arrested for a theft he didn't commit. The charge was eventually dismissed, but instead of going free, marshals turned Islas over to ICE. That sparked an intense campaign to limit how law enforcement cooperates with immigration authorities. Advocates stressed Islas was not a violent criminal, and with the help of Connecticut's two senators, ICE released him in July. On the same day, Democratic Governor Dana Malloy signed the Trust Act into law. It allows law enforcement to hand over undocumented immigrants only if they've been convicted of a felony. Community organizer Megan Fountain says the Trust Act is a step in the right direction, but the real change needs to come from the Obama administration.
They're the ones who have started a deportation dragnet, and they're the ones who have the power to stop it.
The Trust Act passed unanimously, but the state judicial branch opposed it. The judiciary says the law is unenforceable because it conflicts with the federal Secure Communities program. For Latino USA, I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil in New Haven.
It's still up in the air. Can local authorities limit their cooperation with a federal agency like ICE? Is the Secure Communities program mandatory? In 2010, the director of the Secure Communities Program, David Venturella, spoke about the possibility of opting out.
There was an impression created that local law enforcement could stop sending fingerprints to the federal government. That is not an option.
But the Connecticut Trust Act provides a caveat. While local police agencies will still run fingerprints through the FBI for criminal background checks, there are now limits on who will be turned over to ICE. Only those with serious criminal histories or deportation orders will be held. Others, like Jose Maria Islas, will be released, even if ICE issues a detainer request. Immigrant rights activists have hailed this local law as a major victory.
The Trust Act passed. We are going to go and give flowers and thank you cards to all those senators and representatives.
We spoke to Connecticut State Senate Majority Leader Martin Looney, one of the most prominent supporters of the state's Trust Act.
Well, first of all, I was a strong advocate for the law because we need to try to make sure that people residing in our communities trust law enforcement and are willing to report crimes to law enforcement. And don't have a sense of being fearful.
The Connecticut Trust Act will go into full effect in January 2014, and it sets seven criteria for determining whether an individual poses a criminal threat, such as a felony conviction or membership in a gang. Senator Looney says so far the state hasn't heard from the federal government. He hopes the Connecticut Trust Act will serve as a precedent, making collaboration on a touchy issue like this one more reasonable.
I believe that that our law establishes a standard for reasonableness that distinguishes major cases from minor cases, distinguishes those who may in fact be a significant risk of criminal harm or security harm from those where the individual does not provide that level of threat.
So as Connecticut goes, so does the nation? Well, we'll have to wait to find out. For now, look up Latino USA on Facebook and let us know how Secure Communities is impacting your community. Tell us your stories. And now, that word, deportation. The Obama administration has deported almost 2 million people since 2009, a record number. Mexican deportees are often released into border cities, late at night, into places they've never been to, where they know no one, and where everyone has heard just how dangerous these places have become. A human rights group, the Washington Office on Latin America, says deported immigrants are often left with no documentation, no money, and no resources to protect themselves. Maria Inés Zamudio, a journalist with the Chicago Reporter, traveled to Matamoros, Mexico, to find out more.
It is Wednesday morning. I'm standing at the U.S. side of the international bridge that connects Brownsville, Texas to Matamoros, Mexico. And in a couple of minutes, I'll be crossing the border.
The contrast from the quiet settings of Brownsville, Texas into Matamoros is striking.
Here, Mexican soldiers patrol the streets with assault rifles, and shootouts between rival cartels often paralyze the city.
I'm afraid.
Reynaldo Hernandez was deported from Illinois a few months ago. I meet him outside the bus station in Matamoros. This is his second day here.
I couldn't sleep all night thinking about it. They can kidnap me because they think I'm coming from up north, and I have money with me.
Hernandez is with a new friend, Eduardo Ruiz, a deportee from Indiana. The men are stranded here with no means to get back to their hometowns, more than 500 miles away. Ruiz says they stick together for protection.
I haven't been here in 15 years. No one feels safe in Mexico with all the crime. In the U.S., they speak so badly about Mexico, and more so of the border cities.
The deportees don't trust strangers, but they do trust each other, says Alejandro Mota.
We're never alone. Every time we go to the store to buy something, we go together and we come back here. No one knows anyone here. We have nowhere else to go.
Mota is standing outside the bus station with dozens of other deportees, eating bread and coffee donated by a local Catholic church. The church also sponsors the local migrant shelter. It's the only shelter in town, even though there were more than 62,000 deportations here last year. Teresa Delgadillo Resendiz runs the shelter.
Here, we give the immigrants food, a change of clothes, and a place to stay while they try to get in touch with their relatives.
Delgadillo says she can accommodate up to 200 deportees who are returned to Matamoros. She advises them not to leave unless it's absolutely necessary.
There's a lot of violence on the streets. They've grabbed immigrants and they've beaten them badly.
During the 2 days I spend in Matamoros, I realized just how dangerous the city really is. When I interview the deportees eating breakfast, another man who claims to be an immigrant starts asking me who I am and why I'm taking photos. My driver, Samuel Lopez, who's worked with many journalists in dangerous parts of Mexico, says something seems off.
Because if he was a real deportee, he wouldn't have a backpack and a cell phone, and he had both.
But that isn't our only warning. At the shelter, two state workers insist that we leave. They say it's just too risky to stay. Samuel tells me we should take their advice.
I think that when people start telling you, be very careful, be careful, be careful, that's a big sign, and you realize that if someone tells you it's time to go, it's time to go.
I cut my reporting short by 1 day. As I'm finishing up, I think about the options that could help these guys. Congress is considering a bill that would end nighttime deportations, and the Department of Homeland Security has started a program to send deportees directly to Mexico City, which is safer. From a payphone near the International Bridge, I call one of the deportees at the shelter. He tells me that two men came looking for me. Thankfully, I'm already heading north. Unlike him, I can go back to the safety of Texas. For Latino USA, I'm Maria Inés Zamudio in Matamoros, Mexico.
Support for our story was provided by the Fund for Investigative Journalism. And now, immigration. Now, you might think that immigration reform could make it easier for people to enter the U.S., but one change proposed in Congress may actually have the opposite effect, the elimination of the Diversity Visa Program. It's a lottery that makes room for people from countries with low rates of immigration to the U.S. Latin Americans generally don't qualify for the lottery because they come from countries with high immigration rates. But for people in Africa, parts of Asia, or the Caribbean, the Diversity Visa Lottery may be their only way to come here. From Washington, Matt Laszlo has our story.
Living in Mogadishu, Somalia's capital, taught Abdi Nor Iftin about survival. When civil war was raging there a few years ago, he had to dodge bullets and even mortars as he darted through the streets giving English lessons. Abdi remembers the danger, even at home.
I had to dig a cave underneath my bed. That's a way to be safe. And the walls are not that concrete. They are made of soft bricks. So bullets that are fired from like kilometers away can penetrate through the walls and through the ceilings.
Now Abdi, who's 26, is a refugee in Kenya, but he's always dreamed of coming to America, something his friends picked up on.
So they just started calling me American.
Abdi applied twice for a student visa, but was rejected. Then he found out about the Diversity Visa Program, a visa lottery for countries that have low rates of immigration to the U.S. Almost half of those visas go to Africans. In May, Abdi was randomly picked.
So yeah, I couldn't believe it. I just had to look at it again and again.
He showed his acceptance message to his friend at a cyber cafe.
I was saying, the friend was saying like, you think this is true? And I was like, what? This is true. He said, just give it a try again. Then I had to put my confirmation number again. My fingers were kind of shivering. I just need the same message. And then it comes up. It's beautiful.
Abdi was incredibly lucky. More than 10 million people worldwide apply annually for just over 50,000 slots in the Diversity Visa Program. But now the door that opened for him may be closing.
It's very difficult to justify lottery being good, being the way that we should do immigration policy.
That's Florida Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart speaking at the Capitol. He opposes the very idea behind the lottery.
So it's not you know, who gets it, who doesn't get it. It's the fact that you have a lottery to determine, you know, who comes into the United States is something I think is very difficult to justify.
Another Republican, House Judiciary Chair Bob Goodlatte, lambasted the program at his very first immigration hearing.
It is instructive to note that while America selects about 12% of our legal immigrants on the basis of their education and skills, the other main immigrant-receiving countries of Australia, the United Kingdom, and Canada each select over 60% of their immigrants on this basis.
The debate over the diversity visa lottery hasn't gotten much attention because of the focus on the 11 million undocumented immigrants, mostly Latino, who are already in the U.S. But for people like Missouri Democrat Emmanuel Cleaver of the Congressional Black Caucus, the lottery is front and center.
Immigration is about more than Latinos coming into the country. When we talk about fixing the immigration issues in this country, we're talking about ways in which immigrants from all over the planet can come to the United States in a legal and organized fashion.
The Senate's version of immigration reform ends the lottery in 2015. It replaces it with a new program that more than doubles the number of visas offered. But it also sets up a new merit-based system that considers things like education and employment, which can shut out many immigrants from developing countries. Back in Kenya, Abdi Nor Iftin is still awaiting final approval before he can come to the U.S. But he says the Diversity Visa Program remains the only hope for many people like him who come from poor or war-torn countries.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's very hard for them to get to the United States because the other processes are expensive and they take very, very long time.
For Latino USA, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Coming up on Latino USA, a painful September 11th anniversary in Chile.
It's tough to see another September 11th for those who had loved ones killed. They'll never be able to cover up that pain from 1973.
40 years after a coup in South America. Stay with us on Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from Pantaleon Films, presenting Instructions Not Included, the new Spanish-language comedy from one of the producers of Amores Perros, in theaters now.
Welcome back to Latino USA. Bienvenidos. I'm María Hinojosa. The Estadio Nacional in Santiago, Chile is the city's largest. It's a popular venue for concerts and sports events. But this stadium has a bloody past. On September 11, 1973, Socialist President Salvador Allende was ousted and killed in a coup d'etat backed by the U.S. In the weeks that followed, the stadium was turned into a massive torture chamber, a prison for those considered enemies of the state. People held there, many of them college students, were beaten, killed, disappeared. Now, decades later, what markers of memory remain there? Alexandra Hall brings us this postcard from Santiago, Chile.
Bali Kunzman is in charge of the campaign to build a memorial to the tens, possibly hundreds of thousands, imprisoned in the Estadio Nacional after the 1973 coup against President Salvador Allende. She takes me to the part of the stadium that most people don't see. It's a dirt path to the left of the entrance, separated from the street by a metal fence.
Tenía la oportunidad de comunicarse con los compañeros que estaban arriba, allí donde les mostré, y abajo, y se preguntaban mutuamente por sus familiares.
Bali says that people used to crowd on the sidewalk and shout to people on the other side. Mothers looking for their sons, husbands looking for their wives. Inside the stadium hallways, you can still see the places where prisoners carved into the walls with rocks and nails. She points to where they carved out the days, what she can make out of the letters. It's hard to see unless someone points it out. In a corner, if you look closely, there's a name, a date, and something in English. Don't Let Me Down? It's the title of the Beatles song, Don't Let Me Down. This is the record that Bali wants to preserve. She's been trying to get money to build a memorial here for years, but it hasn't been easy. Bali says the process has slowed down, mostly because the government hasn't given any money. She also thinks that it's because some people don't care, because they're young. In a different part of the stadium, a soccer game is about to begin. And it's true, most people standing around are too young to remember what happened here in 1973. But they all have opinions. Paulo Farias is a 31-year-old businessman. He doesn't know anyone who was imprisoned, but he's still sympathetic.
It's tough to see another September 11th for those who had loved ones killed, tortured, hurt. They'll never be able to cover up that pain from 1973.
A few feet away, Alejandro Rosas is here with his family. The year of the coup, he was 12. He didn't think about it then, and he doesn't now.
I don't want to relive it. If people relive everything that happened, we'll stay locked in the past, not in the present or the future.
Then there's a taxi driver. Luis Bailan is parked in front of the main entrance. I asked him why there's no memorial at the Estadio Nacional.
Good question. There should be something. But because no one recognized what happened here and that people died, that's why they don't do it.
Bali says that she expects four memorial sites at the Estadio Nacional to be completed by the start of next year, just in time for the Juegos del Sur, a tournament similar to the Olympics, where 14 Latin American countries will compete in 31 sports. It's a moment for Santiago to present itself to the continent, scars and all. In Santiago de Chile, I'm Alexandra Hall for Latino USA.
I remember watching the coup against Salvador Allende live on the evening news in 1973, and it was one of the most important political events in my life at that time. So it's a bit haunting to remember that intervention in Chile, especially in light of our country's recent walk to the brink of attacking Syria. Here's President Barack Obama earlier this week.
Let me make something clear. The United States military doesn't do pinpricks. Even a limited strike will send a message to Assad that no other nation can deliver. I don't think we should remove another dictator with force. We learned from Iraq that doing so makes us responsible for all that comes next. But a targeted strike can make Assad or any other dictator think twice before using chemical weapons.
The Syrian civil war has already displaced millions of people. And for Latinos, that reality of U.S. intervention is all too vivid.
Well, there's a long history of U.S. intervention overseas, dating back to the 19th century.
Robert Litvak is the vice president for scholars at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and worked for the National Security Council under President Bill Clinton. We asked him to compare how the U.S. acted in Chile with our more recent interventions into Libya, Iraq, and potentially Syria.
I think that the contrasts are more striking than the continuities. The exact role that the United States played during those events, whether direct in fomenting the coup or indirect, the context was wholly different.
American intervention in Latin America was predicated on preventing the spread of Soviet influence. One quick example, here's President Ronald Reagan discussing Nicaragua in his 1985 State of the Union address.
The Sandinista dictatorship of Nicaragua, with full Cuban Soviet bloc support, not only persecutes its people, the church, and denies a free press, but arms and provides bases for communist terrorists attacking neighboring states.
Central American civil wars in Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala sent thousands of people northward, fleeing violence. And the United States had a hand, however minor or major, in each of these conflicts. But the history of intervention in Latin America goes back even further. Robert Litvak.
In the case of Chile in 1973, you had the fact that first that the United States had a legacy of intervening within the hemisphere, whether justified or not under the terms of the Monroe Doctrine. And there was a tradition, or there had been a number of instances of that.
There does exist a certain parallel between the U.S. fight against Soviet influence in the past and Russian and Chinese influence today. So what are Latinos to make of the potential for American intervention anywhere in the world, given our shared pasts? Tell us what you think about intervention. Send us a tweet at LatinoUSA or call us at 646-571-1228. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and how best we can reach you. This week, something historic will happen on television. PBS debuts Latino Americans, a six-part series documenting the history of Latinos in the United States, starting all the way from the 1500s. The series took over 4 years to make, and it features interviews with over 100 Latinos. The first two episodes air on Tuesday, September 17th, and we'll be watching and live tweeting, so be sure to join the conversation using the hashtag LatinoPBS. Now we're joined by Vicky Ruiz. She's a historian and a professor at UC California at Irvine. She's featured throughout the series and joins us from KUCI in Irvine, California. Welcome to Latino USA, Vicky.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're also joined by Jose Fulgencio. He's a young Latino blogger who just watched the series, and he joins us from KGOU in Oklahoma City. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you, Maria.
Okay, so Vicky and Jose, you both recently watched the first two episodes of this six-part series, The Latino Americans. So what did you think? Let's start with you, Jose.
I think it was very eye-opening to me in terms of, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo and about the lynchings of Hispanos in Texas. So it was really mind-opening. And then the wealthy individuals, wealthy Hispanics in New Mexico, I was like, well, I never knew about this. About people like Dolores del Rio, Hector Garcia, and Jose Marti.
You can keep going. Wow. So, Vicky, when you hear someone like Jose, who is now, able to rattle off these historical moments of, Latino presence in the United States, you're a historian. I mean, that must make you thrilled.
It certainly does. In fact, I'm going to tell my students that basically the Cliff Notes version of my course is in the video.
So we're going to play a clip from the series now. This is from Hour 2, and it gives a really interesting perspective in terms of what happened with the very first deportations of Latinos, of Mexicanos, in the 1930s. Let's take a listen.
President Hoover, by 1931, is desperate to stay in office.
He is roundly blamed for the Depression. And he begins to look for scapegoats. And it's his Secretary of Labor who begins to say, well, you know, if we simply got rid of Mexicans, we would have jobs for everyone else.
Vicky, that is a very particular moment in U.S. history. Tell us about it and its aftermath.
Well, between 1931 and 1934, from 500,000 to 1 million Mexicanos are deported or repatriated from the United States to Mexico.
Initially in 1931, when they start this, they have no problem filling the trains. There are plenty of people who are unemployed, who want to go back. By 32, county welfare officials begin to target neighborhoods that they know have a large number of unemployed Mexicans. They will say, the cheese that you're getting, the bread we have been giving you, is no longer going to be made available to you. Instead, we will give you this one ticket, and this is for a ride back to Mexico on a train.
These deportations occurred throughout the Southwest and the Midwest, from Los Angeles to Gary, Indiana. However, Los Angeles, the impact is felt most keenly, because when you think of the fact that the Mexican population of California at that time is 350,000, 75,000 people left Los Angeles, either on the repatriation trains, on jalopies with mattresses on the top, heading south, or actually rounded up and deported. That means that almost every Mexican family in Los Angeles area had to decide whether they were going to stay or whether they were going to go.
We arrived at the train station that was very crowded. People crying, children and adults. I was approached by a man. He says that I could stay here, but I would become a ward of the state. You know, like you hear about these orphanages. I didn't want to be in an orphanage. I wanted to be with my father and my brother. I had a family.
Jose, I wanted to ask you a question about kind of as you were growing up. You're a blogger now. You're based in Oklahoma. You grew up in Chicago, which is a very Latino-aware city. So how much of this history did you know, actually, before watching these hours in the series?
Well, in terms of, you know, well, of course I knew, you know, Hispanics living in California, Texas, you know, my dad would tell me. But a bunch of this thing was eye-opening to me. In our schools, you know, in elementary, middle school, and high school, they really didn't teach us this.
Vicky, you know, part of the motivation of this series is to teach young Latinos like Jose about their own history. But why aren't we learning about it in schools?
Unfortunately, our schools have become the pressures they face in terms of preparing their students for tests that's still very date-driven and very driven by sort of conventional East Coast narratives. The idea that the first European settlement in Jamestown in 1607, when actually, of course, it's St. Augustine in 1565. But it's part of a historical amnesia when it comes to Latino history.
Jose, what has changed for you now that you have this visual story of Latino history? And you only saw the first 2 hours. Of course, it goes on for 6 hours. But what's changed for you?
I think I learned more about, you know, the culture I come from, the history that. And now I go, well, if you watch this series, you can see we've been here for hundreds of years. Ancestors have been here for hundreds of years, way before, you know, the landing of Plymouth Rock. So it gives me that sense that, you know, I've always belonged here and you know, my family. And I can also see what my grandfather was talking about, because one of my grandfathers, he was a bracero. And so he came and told me the story about how he was selected in the lines and, you know, to be working in the United States during the bracero program. So, and hearing about that, it gives me more sense of a pride.
If you are a strapping young man and you're coming across that Staten Street Bridge, there would be recruiters from Pennsylvania, from Idaho, from Utah, from Colorado, from California, all over, wanting your labor, bidding for your labor.
Jose Fulgencio, thank you so much for joining us from KGOU in Oklahoma City, where you are a blogger. And Professor Vicky Ruiz, you're a professor of history at UC Irvine. Thank you for joining us from KUCI in Irvine. Muchas gracias to the both of you.
Thank you.
Gracias, Maria.
So today, mis queridos amigos, we've talked about some pretty heavy issues. Intervention, immigration, deportation, challenging your government. All topics that have affected the lives of so many Latino families. And still, it's a past that can linger. For this week's Sabiduría, or Wisdom, we hear from author, educator, and retired Army Lieutenant Consuelo Castillo Kickbush. She's Mexican-American, Native American, and she grew up in Texas, one of 10 children, 8 of whom were in the service. Today, she shares with us a Consueloism about carrying our histories with us sin pena.
One of my Consueloisms is you cannot understand where you're going till you've understood where you have been. And embracing your past, whether it was painful, hard to even go there, forgiveness of those things that you wish to leave there is not the gift you give to others. It is the gift you give yourself. All the things and the baggage that we carry in life, we need to put it somewhere. We need to embrace it. Otherwise, it's like a cancer. It stays in your soul. It eats you up. Beauty includes those broken lines. It includes your brokenness. Beauty includes understanding what to do with hopelessness. Many of us stop short of saying, I'm a victim. We might graduate to being a survivor, but freedom lies in saying I'm a role model. I'm going to go there and I'm going to talk about it because it will not claim me, nor will it define me. It is simply a part of my history. So this brokenness is part of the whole. And while you'll never piece it together, you can still try to hold it together.
The words of Consuelo Castillo Kickbush and Sabiduría. And for this week, that's our show. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. This week, we had additional engineering from Brendan Baker and Stephanie LeBeau, and additional reporting by Rebecca Plevin at KVPR. Special thanks to Luis Antonio Perez at WBEZ in Chicago and to Radio Cooperativa in Santiago, Chile. Adrián Florido and María Inés Zamudio are reporters for Fronteras, the Changing America Desk. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, María Hinojosa. I hope you join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, so we're never that far away. Thanks for listening.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Pantaleon Films, presenting Instructions Not Included, the new Spanish-language comedy from one of the producers of Amores Perros, in theaters now. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. This is NPR.